I decided I would do some business coaching. Some of that just fell into my lap from people I knew that needed help in their businesses. And really, from that experience of doing that for a couple of years, I noticed that all the businesses that I was coaching at the time had similar the same sort of problem, regardless of the industry they were in, whether they were online or offline. It didn't actually matter. And the problem went like this: if they didn't hire staff, they weren't really going to be able to get out of the plateau they were at. So usually, like, a business owner starts a business and then gets to a certain level, and then they plateau, because in order to scale it further, you need to start getting into operational frameworks, systems, processes, getting support teams in, delegation, all the things that actually I accidentally found out I was quite good at, but a lot of business owners are not very good at that. And then a lot of the problem is that sometimes the work that needs to get done doesn't really warrant hiring a local person to do it. And you sort of think, I'll just do it myself. This is what was happening. Or the team say that they'll just do it. But if we don't free up the time and energy of key people in a business, the business struggles to grow. It struggles to scale.
Hello, I'm John Brink and I'm podcasting on the Brink from downtown Prince George, British Columbia, Canada. And for all those people watching us from around the world, they say, okay, we know where Canada is. And we heard about British Columbia. And we know that big city in British Columbia called Vancouver. So where are you in British Columbia, John? Well, we are about 500 miles north of Vancouver, or for our friends in Europe, 800 kilometers. And that puts us physically in the center of British Columbia, north, south, east, west. Big province. So all around us is forest, lots of trees, within 50 miles, 100 lakes. We have black bears, grizzly bears, caribou, deer, wolf, you name it, we have it. Living in harmony with nature. An absolute, fabulous, beautiful spot. Now, you have to make me one commitment that don't tell anybody about this, otherwise they all want to come here. I'm just kidding. So, today we got a very, very special guest. Her name is Barbara Turley. And Barbara is in particular interested in VA, virtual assistant, and very involved in it, set up a company, is an entrepreneur, and a very interesting discussion with Barbara. Barb, tell us about you. Where are you from? When did you start your background, your education, and then take us forward.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on the show. And British Columbia, gosh, where you live sounds wonderful to me. I am Irish background, so I hail from close to where you hail, John, in Europe, but I live the other end of the world in Sydney, Australia.
Oh my
goodness. So I've lived in Sydney for 20 years now, and I always say the same as what you do. If it was closer to Europe, everyone would be here because it's such a wonderful place to live. So
right.
It's one of the most beautiful places in the world to live.
Right.
In Sydney. So yes, I hail from Ireland. To cut the long story short, I didn't always have the entrepreneurial blood. You know, I didn't grow up thinking I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I actually was very much in corporate, and I spent most of my career, first 15 years of my career, was in corporate in the financial sector.
Okay.
So I was an equity trader for a long time, for 8 years on a trading floor. And then I moved into asset management sales. And through that journey, I actually got an opportunity to get involved in a startup of sorts in the financial industry back in 2009. So the last big financial crash that the world had, I sort of got an opportunity then. And I learned a lot by getting involved in that company about how great companies get built. Now, I wasn't founder or anything close to that in that company. I just happened to get an opportunity to hop on the coattails of some other great people. But it whetted my appetite for entrepreneurship. And that was really where this sort of thing started for me. And I was well into my 30s at that stage.
Right.
Yeah. So that was kind of the start of things.
So what kind of a company was that? So you went from financial to the new company that you kind of got into it when they were forming it, moving forward. What did they do?
I'm actually still involved a little bit in the company today. It's an asset management company in Australia.
Okay.
So they manage, I mean, they do all sorts of things today, but it started out very much as a fund management company in the wealth management space. And today they do all sorts of other things, but it's primarily in the wealth management space in Australia.
So that means that they are investing capital from others that they attract, and they invested then primarily into real estate.
Actually, not really. It's more equities and bond based. So they also there's relationships with different great fund managers all around the world.
So it expanded substantially from Australia. So it now is
Australia based, but the company finds great fund managers around the world for international equities, for international, you know, hedge funds and things like that, and actually brings them to Australia to distribute into that market. So it's that sort of a play.
So you're talking about funds just for a guest around the world. Yeah. What are funds? What are hedge funds?
Are we going to go down this rabbit hole? We can.
No. Just to have a general idea. So they attract capital, and some of that you mentioned is hedge funds.
The easiest way to explain it is everybody in the world, well, most people have some sort of, well, in countries like Canada, Australia, Britain, Ireland, Europe, they've got pension funds, superannuation funds, they call them. Right. Most of us have an investment in some sort of a retirement portfolio. Most of us don't even know what that is, but usually what that is the money is invested in a suite of managed funds, and managed funds are just a way of collecting money together and then having a fund manager manage the equities or which would be stocks and bonds and companies that they buy so that you don't have to. So it's a managed approach to something.
And to get
hedge funds, different. Hedge funds are more, they're called an alternative asset, so they can do more crazy things. Sometimes they're conservative, they can be anything from conservative things right up to high risk types of strategies that are not for everyone.
They are more delicate and more at risk. Obviously, they get a higher return because of that. But also the risk side is more heavier, I would say.
Well, actually, interestingly, not always. Sometimes they're designed to mitigate the other risks. So they're actually like a balancing effect.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily more risky. They just have a different type of approach to what they're investing in. Yeah.
Okay, take us a bit further. So you were involved there or are still somewhat involved there. Where do you go from there?
Well, I decided after 5 years of being an employee and a shareholder in that company, I decided it was time for me to do my own thing. I just felt this burning need to explore what I was going to do by myself. And I didn't really know what that was, is the honest truth. And I think many people in a corporate role would experience that. They go, I want to do something. I'm just not sure what it is. So I decided I would do some business coaching. Some of that just fell into my lap from people I knew that needed help in their businesses. From that experience of doing that for a couple of years, I noticed that all the businesses that I was coaching at the time had the same sort of problem, regardless of the industry they were in, whether they were online or offline, it didn't actually matter. And the problem went like this. If they didn't hire staff, they weren't really going to be able to get out of the plateau they were at. So usually like a business owner starts a business and then gets to a certain level. And then they plateau because in order to scale it further, you need to start getting into operational frameworks, systems, processes, getting support teams in, delegation, all the things that I accidentally found out I was quite good at, but a lot of business owners are not very good at that. And then a lot of the problem is that sometimes the work that needs to get done doesn't really warrant hiring a local person to do it. And you sort of think, I'll just do it myself. This is what was happening. Or the team say that they'll just do it. But if we don't free up the time and energy of key people in a business, the business struggles to grow. It struggles to scale. So I had never even been to the Philippines, to be totally honest, but I had read about virtual assistants in the Philippines. And I said, what about if I try to find some cost-effective staff in the Philippines purely to solve this problem for clients that I saw? And I was doing it more with the idea that if I can get them out of the weeds of doing all the work, then we can work on strategy as me, the business coach. But what ended up transpiring is that that was really successful for the clients that I was working with. And before I knew it, I was getting calls from friends of clients saying, not can you be my business coach, but can you get me one of those VAs? And I thought, well, you can get them yourself online. But people were so busy and overwhelmed already that I just realized they needed somebody to do it for them. And I just woke up one day and I literally found myself in a new business. I had about 10 VAs in the Philippines. And I was like, wow, I'm in a business here.
Right.
And that was the start of it, really.
So Denise is really, as I hear it, Barbara, is that I've been in business for, I'm nearly 84, so I'm still in business. I have probably 10 different companies. You know, I've gone through all the ups and downs. Wrote a book about that, actually, Against All Odds. That's not hoorah, hoorah, how successful John is, but all the ups and downs along the way. And, you know, so what I found from my experience is that right-sizing a company is likely the most important. If you're too small, you run into the problems that you indicated. If you're not big enough, then, or as you grow, you will get into the one stage, to the next stage, to the next stage, so that as it becomes potentially larger, then you have to make sure that you manage the emerging new entity correctly or properly. Otherwise, you bury people in issues that maybe they're not familiar with, and it creates all kinds of issues inside the organizations. So for me, starting with 3 employees, myself doing hands-on work, working 24/7 in a lumber company, starting it from the ground up, new product, new markets, and working 7 days a week as long as I could stay awake. And then growing that company where now, 50 years later, we have 3 silos. The one is lumber, the other one is warehousing and distribution and logistics, the other one, 4 actually, the other one is real estate, residential, commercial, and industrial, and the other one is media. Media means books, speaking, podcasting, platform. That's kind of where I am today. And the company is growing, and each of the segments likely will again double in size in the next 4 to 5 years.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, that's the holy grail of scaling a company, right? And I mean, I think so many, you know, I do have a sort of a philosophy that I'm not sure will resonate as much as I think it should. But I think one of the reasons that a lot of startups actually die and fail is that if the startups that get product to market fit right, okay, there's ones that never get it right, but the ones that get product to market fit right, and they go into scale phase, they actually go into, I think Vern Harnish, who wrote the Scaling Up book, calls it the Valley of Death, where actually the scale phase is where the valleys of death exist, and you can die in the crevices between startup and growth.
Correct.
If you don't operationalize properly and you don't get the right organizational people stack going, you spend too much money. Like, a lot of people forget that one of the most expensive assets in any business is your people. Yeah. And yet we're burning their time, their energy, their brain power with spending half of their day sometimes doing stuff that could be process mapped and delegated to a great team of support assistants. And the most cost effective way to do that is in places like that.
And then for the entrepreneur, leadership is the most critical part, acquiring the skill sets surrounding leadership. A lot of entrepreneurs do not have that naturally. In fact, in a lot of cases, entrepreneurs are good at a particular level, but then have to acquire new skills as they go forward. But that means that if you grow or steadily grow like I did, over 50 years, the company starts here. I'm hands-on, make all the decisions with 3 employees. Then we go to the next level, and now all of a sudden we got 10 or 12. Now we go to the next level, and on and on and on until where we are today. We're probably employing around 400 people or so, but we are now again negotiating where we will double or triple our companies. And so again, I have to go to next the level. Next level, and all of those kind of things. And you must be able to manage that process. Go ahead.
It's funny because, you know, you were saying you've got 400 employees. I mean, you've scaled an incredible company. I mean, I was reading about you before coming on this podcast, and it's very inspiring, you know. But what you're saying about leveling up, I mean, I've experienced this myself. I kind of went from what they call extreme founder mode, where you're making all the decisions. And I took the approach where I built all of the process maps, all of the systems. And then I delegated first to cost-effective support teams, where I was more the strategist all the time in every department. Exactly. And eventually you have to move up from that and you have to start putting in managers and department heads. But what I found is, and I'm sure this might resonate with you and some of the people listening, is that the more delegation's a funny thing. We're all told as founders to delegate, delegate, delegate. But if you delegate away too much too early, in terms of the strategic side, you can actually lose the connection to the business.
Exactly.
Now, the Airbnb CEO spoke about this on a podcast recently, and he actually got rid of an entire layer of management staff and went back into the weeds himself because of this. It was Brian Chesky. And I have found at times myself doing that in my company, which has been very beneficial.
Thanks, Stephen Jobs.
Yes. Now,
when they fired him from Apple, although he was the founder, he died far too young, but he's been a classic example. And then he bought another company, made it extremely successful. They bought the company, and then again, he rose to the top in Apple. But the key for me is that I've gone through it. A lot of times what happens to good leaders that build companies, they are very good at building companies, not necessarily very good at day-to-day managing. So the other thing that I found, Barb, is, and that's why I write the books that I do. I have to show you this one actually here. That's my last book.
Yeah, I see that in the background behind you. That's what I want.
That's me.
Living young. I know.
I'm the oldest competitive bodybuilder in North America.
And
I qualified for the Arnolds in 2018, and then COVID came, and so now I'm getting ready to again go to the Arnolds in 2025. So I'm training for that. Now, if you know Arnold, can you please tell him the next time you see him that John Brink, tell him I'll be back.
I will. I'll be sure to say that. You know, well, next time I'm having coffee with Arnie, I'll do that.
So the other part that I was going to say is that what I found from my experience is that a critical part for leadership, entrepreneurship, is always delicate, because will they become leaders in day-to-day managing of the companies? And then what is the most critical part I have found? I'm writing another book about that. It's about communications. You must become an effective communicator. It's probably one of the most important parts as a leader that you must be able to do.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And, you know, if I could say, so this is an interesting topic for me, because communication, I mean, look, how many marriages have broken down because communication was bad? Business partnerships, it's actually, communication is so fundamental to our success in any type of relationship, be it parent-child, spouse, partner, business partner, or leadership team to employees, and back up, employees back up to leadership teams. So communication is something, I'm a naturally reasonably good communicator. However, what I've noticed over the years is when you're communicating with a lot of people and your leadership team, you'll notice that if you don't clarify what those people have heard from you, sometimes everyone's going to hear a different message, because they're putting their own lens on it. They're looking at some what you're saying through the lens of their own experience. Now, this gets difficult at scale, right? So how do you know that your message is cutting through to all of your 400 employees, for example, or all of my 350 employees? One of the ways that I have tried to bridge that gap, because I have noticed that things can fall through the cracks when you think you're communicating effectively, but people are picking it up differently, is to actually have this kind of two-way mechanism of communicating. it's hard to do this at scale, but the way we have done it and the way it's kind of working for us is we have this mantra at the Virtual Hub that your voice matters, that your voice drives everything here. And we do it through random sort of surveys. We do polling all the time, and we invite people to voice their opinion, even anonymously, so they can say what they truly think. And we do this 2 or 3 times a year so that we get feedback on what we're communicating as a leadership team and how that's being heard and interpreted by our people and what they think about it. And that's been sort of painful sometimes, because when you hear negative criticism or you hear stuff back from the employees that you don't like, but it's the gold that helps you to create a better culture by listening to your people. So that's communication for me. It's very important.
Yeah. And I have experience with it in the sense that I didn't used to be a very good communicator. And part of that is that, just giving you a little bit more background about me, that I was born in Holland, as you already indicated. I was not a success story academically. I failed grade 3 and I failed grade 7 3 times. And so then they said, what are we going to do with this guy? And they said to my parents, they said, well, send him to the mentally challenged school. They said, no, we're not going to do that. We'll teach him a trade. And my grandfather was a master carpenter. My dad worked in lumber. And so they said, I was 13 then, they sent me to a furniture factory. And then in the evenings, I would go to the college and become a furniture maker. Now, kids are hard on each other. And all the friends that I used to have, they went on to college and university. And I became a laborer. I'm proud of that today. But then it was kind of looked down on. And so that's what I did. And, and then the other part I should just note, as you already know, I was born in 1940. I remember the Second World War well. And the first thing that I knew about it, my dad was drafted into the Dutch army. The last time they saw him was in the bombing of Rotterdam. And we didn't know for 5 years if he was dead or alive or would survive. My mom was on her own and with 3 kids. I had a brother, 2 years older than me, sister, 1 year older. But I remember all the bombers overhead, hundreds of Allied bombers bombing Germany. And we were in the northeastern part of Holland. And my mom used to take us out in the evenings. And in the distance, we could see the cities burning. The sky would be red. And so the reason that she took us out, not to look at this, but she felt safer outside than inside. And then the next thing that I remember, April the 12th, 1945, we were liberated by the Canadian Army. And, it left such an impression on me that I always knew I would go to the land of my heroes, Canada. So finally, I was going to go when I was 17, was drafted into the Dutch Air Force for 2 years. And then finally, I went to Canada when I was 23. And I wanted to start with nothing to prove to me that I could do it. I was just as smart as the other people that went on to college and university, not better than, but at least equally to. But I had to prove that to me. So I went with a suitcase, 3 books, 2 sets of clothes. And then I flew into Montreal, took the train across Canada, Montreal to Vancouver. Oh my God, that's a long way. 4 days, 5 nights. And came off the train in Vancouver, went to the immigration office, and there was a German fellow, so I could speak no English, and I told him, I could speak some German, told him, but I want to build a lumber mill. And that's what I wanted to do. And so he said, go to Prince George. That's where I am today, 60 years later. And so that's what I did. I can still see the bus, the place where the Greyhound bus used to arrive here, about 2.5 blocks up from here. And I came off the bus July 1965. I had my suitcase, 3 books, 2 sets of clothes, and I counted my money at least 3 times as to what I had. I had $25.47.
And I read about that.
You did, yeah. But what I did have, attitude, and I still do that today. I even did when I was a young boy. I always believe in the positive. If it's a tough day today, I know it's going to be a better day tomorrow. The other one, passion. Whatever I do, I give it 150%. I still do that now, even today. Work ethic, I work harder than anybody. And even now at nearly 84, I always get up at 5:30 in the morning. I always make my bed and I always think I'm late. So that's what I do now. But the story that I was going to tell you, that when I arrived here, it took me 32 years of being here, and started out as a cleanup man, then lumber pilot, blah, blah, blah. Always with the dream of building a mill. And so then I became a supervisor or a superintendent already after I was here for a year. Within 2 years, I was part manager of a small little mill. And then, here in Prince George, I started this company, Brink Forest Products, with one mill and a smaller mill with three employees, as I said earlier. And one day I went into a bookstore here in Prince George in 1997. I picked up a book. I still don't know why I did, but this is the actual book that I picked up, Driven to Distraction.
I've heard of that book, actually.
Yeah, written by Dr.
I think my mom used to say when we were kids, I think I remember my mom saying, I'm driven to distraction with you all.
Maybe she referred to this. Written by Dr. Halliwell, who is a medical doctor, but also has written about 18 books, 5 books about distraction, ADHD and dyslexic. So am I.
Yes.
But I had no idea until I read this book, and as I stood there and going through it, and I heard about ADHD, I'd never heard of it. I had no idea even what it was. And I said, oh my God, this is me. And I wrote, this is what I wrote, January 1997, in Dutch, because I was ashamed of it. Now I finally know who I am.
Oh, wow, that's so powerful.
And so that's what happened. And then
that's a really strong message for all of the kids out there. You know, there's still our education system is still a disaster.
I agree with you. That's why I wrote this. Yeah, I agree with you. I agree.
Yeah, Richard Branson is talking about it now. Richard Branson is out talking about it, which is amazing. But our education system still does not cater.
I agree.
For those who are outside of the narrow circle. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, what we're doing now, just drifting off the topic, because since you raised the topic, when I wrote this book here, Driven to Distraction, ADHD Unlocked, so that you can pick up the book anywhere, go either one direction or the other, it's all interesting. So it's written with the ADHD mind. But the other part about it is that when I wrote it about my experience with ADHD, I already was then convinced, after a number of years checking out Google and knowing more and more about ADD, it is a superpower. And
yes.
I know it is a superpower. And then as I was writing this book that would hopefully be helpful for others about ADHD, one day I was sitting in an airplane on the way to, I called it an overseas flight between Vancouver and Victoria. It's 12 minutes, actually. And so I was sitting next to a fella, and he said to me, you remember who I am? And I said, I somewhat remember you. And his name was Tom Bromer. He was a professor at the British Columbia Institute of Technology. And he said, I know you were writing a book. And I said, it was Against All Odds. He said, yeah. I said, I'm writing another one, actually, about ADHD. And he said, oh, my goodness, that is interesting about the, precisely as you said, our teaching system is not working well, in my opinion, for a number of reasons. And he said, we are working on something. Then the plane stopped. He got off the plane. And then the following week, I was sitting in 5A and he was sitting in 1F and the plane was full and I said, Tom, and the other looking and say, what is he doing? I said, stop by the gate, I need to talk to you. And so he stopped by the gate on the way out. And I said, you were talking about what are you doing at the British Columbia Technology Center? He said, It's about training, certification. We are looking at what they call micro certification. And I said, click, because my book, I tell the story about ADHD, but I felt right at the end, the book is done, but something is missing, because I make analysis, it's a good book, tell about my story and other people's, but I'm not, there must be another point to the book. So, John, where do we go from here? And that exactly deals with the training system. Micro certification in principle. So I talked to Tom about it. He wrote a little piece in the book about it, and it is being practiced in other areas. What is it all about? If you sit in a school and you sit there for 3 years, 4 years, then probably only 20% maybe of it relates to what exactly you want to do. All the other things are additives. The focus should be on that area that you're being trained for, whatever that is, obviously, and should be modified so that people are not sitting in schools, especially those with ADHD or trauma of some sort or another, that have difficulty doing that. And the focus should be on that. The others should become additives that they can add at some different time. So the focus is on the core issue, micro-certification. That made a lot of sense to me.
I think actually, now that I think about school, I mean, one of the basic things they could change without changing the entire education system is actually the whole premise that we walk into a classroom and we sit for hours on end in front of a teacher that teaches. You know, I'm almost imagining a school where there are, you know, sometimes there are two or three classes in a year. So there might be like my daughter's in year two, there's three classes of them. You could actually have a system where one class is taught in a certain way, like out in the playground. It's an outdoor learning experience. And another one is sit in the classroom. Another one is taught through song or something. I don't know, but it would be like a way to allow children to self-select, which they're all learning the same stuff technically, but from a different way of teaching.
I agree.
And then a child can self-select which class they would like to join.
Exactly.
And try it out. Exactly. Well, like maybe I learn better because I'm sitting, I don't know, out in the playground learning letters and the words of all the things in the trees, or, you know, forest school is the way that they do
what that. What is happening now, Barb, and I know that is in Canada, but I also know the United States and the rest of the world, is that the system that we have in most places are not effective, and it should be changed in a different way. The other part is important. Talking about ADHD in particular, Dr. Halliwell, that wrote the book Driven to Distraction, is one of the foremost specialty is ADHD around the world. And so you are podcast number 313 for me as a host, 203 on the Brink with John A. Brink. Is a podcast with Dr. Halliwell. So that can you believe it? And so in our conversation, I suggested to him, he's the expert, that I had found that initially I thought that maybe 8% of the population ADHD. And then the more I found out about it, the more I read about it, I believe I suggested to Dr. Halliwell that it is probably more than 20%. He said, no, John, it's more than 25%. I agree with him.
Wow. Yeah. Undiagnosed, realize they're ADHD.
The other part about it, Barb, is that I believe, and I've been in business, I've been in boards of directors and all of the things all around business like you have, you know, is that, but I have found that, in my opinion, of the successful operativists, successful entrepreneurs and CEOs, I suggested to Dr. Halliwell that probably 50% of them is ADHD. He said, no, John, probably 75%.
And I heard that.
I agree with him, you know, so. Yeah. Now, the other part that I just want to share, I get so excited about this, but the other thing that I want to share with you is about communication. I feel so strongly about that. So that up to the time that in the 80s. I was already successful. I had all these businesses and everybody said, oh, you're so successful. I didn't feel that way. And so somebody said to me, and I could communicate maybe with two or three people in my company, but outside of that, not very good at all. And a lot of times anxiety and not feeling confident and all of that kind of stuff. Then somebody said to me, why don't you come with me to the Toastmasters? I said, what is that all about? And he said, Toastmasters, you talk about communications. I said, are they going to ask me any questions? No, you just sit there, watch it, and see what they are doing. It's all about communicating. And I said, okay. So I went down there and watched everybody. And then in the middle of the meeting, they said, hey, John, tell us all about who are you? And I said, oh, my God, I'll never go back here. But I did. And I stayed there for 10 years. And I became a distinguished Toastmaster, which is the highest level in Toastmasters. There probably, as we speak, there are 450,000 people in North America in Toastmaster clubs in your community, mine here even in Prince George, at these three clubs here. And all around the world, probably tens of millions of people have had part of Toastmasters. Probably less than 1% of them feel they take as much as they need. I was an exception because I was so bad. I went to the highest level, and it changed my life. No question about that. And it made me successful. And I was in Toastmasters from 1990 to 2000. And then from there on in, everything changed for me and my life as a businessman. And it gave me then the opportunity to become not only just a good communicator, but also a keynote in-demand speaker around North America. And so that's it changed my world, really. And it gave me confidence.
In talking about these topics, right, of communication, learning style, and confidence. So I've probably hired, like, we have 350 employees now. I've been doing this for 9 years. And I'm only in the Philippines, but that's like a little cosmos in itself. So if I think about these topics, right, what I really see is the best people that we've ever hired, right? And I actually changed the entire business model based on this. The best people that we've ever hired are those that skills are things you can train, right? You can teach people how to do, you know, digital marketing support tasks, all sorts of processes. That's actually irrelevant, right? So a lot of companies are trying to hire for experience. And I go, you know what? Experience is fine. But actually, if you hire for ability to communicate, understanding someone's learning style, you don't have to hire for a specific learning style, but you must understand their learning style, their communication ability. Now, they don't have to be the best communicator, but they have to have the ability to become and to be coached into that. Learning style, very important to understand, so that then you can actually train and mentor that person to be the best version of themselves that you can find. And over the years, what I've discovered is we know if we're doing virtual assistants, they're working with our clients who are usually scale-ups internationally. We have Canada, US, Australia. If we can hire the people that have the communication ability or the ability to be coached up into that, to be able to cope with what's happening within scale-ups and the mindset of the people within a scale-up, and understanding that their communication style may not be great. This is how actually I've discovered over the years that is actually the secret to success in this type of business. If we're inserting support assistance into these companies, we need to understand how do we coach those people to understand what they're being told and to communicate more effectively back to that. Now, this is the greatest challenge, though, in the business that I have, is not teaching them how to, you know, work Canva or how to do, you know, scheduling of social media posts or how to get the snippets from this podcast and put them on social media, for example. It's actually, how do I decipher what I'm being asked to do? And then how do I report back effectively to the person I'm reporting to, et cetera, et cetera. And then my learning style. So yeah, that's an interesting topic.
So if you look at somebody like me as an example, I grew up in Northeastern Holland. We speak dialect there. people in most of Holland wouldn't understand me when I speak dialect. I love dialect. I grew up speaking dialect. So when I was 17, I went into the Air Force. I had to learn to speak English, speak Dutch, High Dutch. And then a lot of people said, you come from the farm, and that are all farmers. They don't know anything there in that area. You know, so then...
Double whammy for you.
Then I barely got Dutch under control. Then I leave for Canada, and now I have to learn to speak English. So the I'm just being funny about it, actually. The other point that I was going to make is this one, Barb, is that Toastmasters are becoming good speaker Toastmasters, but I've learned from it in the time that I became the highest level in Toastmasters. But people ask me, what is it all about? I said, contrary to what some people think, it's not about being a good speaker. It is, but not first. The first thing is to become a good listener. And the second one is to become an effective speaker on your feet, that occasions happen to articulate what happened and to respond to an issue. And then it becomes, in a structured way, on topics, become a speaker and make presentations in front of other Toastmasters that will evaluate you. Some good points, area for improvement, a general impression by others. That became the structure. But at becoming a good listener is probably the most important part of being a good speaker.
Well, I think on that, I mean, I spent 5 years in a sales role. So my final corporate role was actually in sales. Now, what I found when I was in this sales role, and lots of people hate the word sales, right? Or the salespeople.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about being in a sales role, the interesting thing about being successful in a sales role is exactly what you're talking about. It's the ability to, number one, deeply listen to what's not being said, because you're trying to find the silent objections, right? In somebody. And then getting ready when you respond to build into your vernacular and in your what you're saying, to build in the ability to tackle silent objections without talking about them. Now, so basically, it's a sort of an influencer tactic, I suppose, but listening to the silent stuff, being able to decipher it, and then being able to very quickly build your argument on a call or in a presentation or when you're selling, and actually refute all of those objections without ever mentioning that you picked up that they were objections. The most successful salespeople in the world know how to do that really well.
Exactly.
And I remember, I hated being in sales because you're always taught like sales tactics.
Yeah.
When actually psychology is what it is.
Yeah.
And deeply understanding another human being. And that's the hardest part. But the most successful salespeople make the other person feel understood and heard really deeply. And then that's how they close sales. That was what I learned anyway from some of the best salespeople that I worked with, that actually understood relationships and psychology.
But it is all the things that you have done from being in the financial community, then moving into marketing, and financial marketing, if you wish, investments, hedge funds, and all those other things that gave you the experience to where you are now is virtual assistant, discovering another model that was a niche, really, and you knew how to put the pieces together on the basis of that, the experience that you had gained of all those years before. And then, obviously, you are a natural born, you may not have discovered it yourself, but you have the natural ability of being an entrepreneur, plus you are a very good communicator, in my opinion.
Well, I've honed it over the years. I've had to, and I have my moments like we all do. I mean, I'm human, yeah. You know, I can be a great communicator for like 90% of the time or 95% of the time. And then there are moments where I will say one of my biggest weaknesses, for example, and any of my team that listen to this will just nod at this. So I'm a really good communicator, 95% of the time. But one of my weaknesses is sometimes I am articulate and I say what I want and I think I'm articulating myself well, but I don't challenge the other person enough when I'm dealing with a leadership situation to articulate back to me what they understand my saying. I assume that because I've articulated it well, that they've got it. And then they don't do the thing that I asked them to do.
Right.
And then I try and do it again. And then I try in a different angle. And then I try a sales pitch. And then I blow up. And then my ability to communicate effectively
that
goes completely out of the window. I lose my crack, like my crap with everyone.
Yeah.
And then they do it. And it happens with my children as well. I go, why do I have to, why do I have to go to that point to be heard? So I'm in a constant battle of trying to figure out what is the bit I'm missing that I have to go to that level to get it done.
My wife does that to me. So the
a women thing.
Yeah. So I have to tell you this one. You will find this funny. So I want to set up a platform, right? So I've been thinking about it for a long time already. So I'm going to get it started probably 2-3 months from now. It's going to be extremely interesting globally. Anyway, so I've been looking at a name because it has to be something that is very, very effective, right? So as soon as you see it, bingo. So I'm thinking about it. I'm laying in bed and it's probably 2:00 in the morning and all of a sudden I got it. And so I said, Sharon, wake up. And she said, what? Why are you waking me up? I said, I got it. Help me remember. This is the name. And she said, I said, don't forget it because, no, she, I'll go back to sleep. I went back to sleep. So I asked her in the morning. I said, what's the name? She said, I forgot. I said, So the following weekend, again, I laid awake all night to find the name to this platform that I'm going to start. And then I got it. I wrote a whole book full of name, and then finally I knew I got it. And then I said, I'm going to write it down this time. And then I told her about it and she liked it. But so that's what will happen. But but I get excited about things. And then even when I give presentations and then I stumble over myself, if I try to articulate the message to somebody, I don't get angry usually, although I can, but not usual. And and I try to be articulate, but I believe that
on that thing of getting angry, I think I've asked a few people after I've sort of had that lose it moment, and I've gone, oh no, was that really bad? And they're like, no, you were just firm. But in my head, I am literally losing. Like I my impression of myself in that moment is very critical because I think, oh my God, I dropped all the. Yeah. All my leadership quality and just dissolved into a mess. But actually, apparently it isn't like that. I'm just extremely firm and they can tell that I'm annoyed. Yeah. but quite professional.
But at the same time, that's what I do. I know where I want to go. There is a reason for doing it. And that's why I'm laying it out. And then after I do that, and then if somebody does something different, then obviously they didn't understand it and they didn't ask me, could you please explain that a little bit better because I'm not getting. But instead, then I say, geez, but anyway, I feel the same. So the other part that I quickly want to get to on your VA and just for all the people watching us, that you go to Philadelphia, to the Philippines. Why the Philippines? Is that it? Are there lots of candidates there that help you, and candidates that become the assistants and virtual assistants?
That's a great question. Now, so the reason I went to the Philippines, I'd love to say that I premeditated this. I was very organized in my thinking about this business. I wasn't. I had gotten a VA for myself online, and she was in the Philippines. So I ended up in the early days getting a lot of her friends to work for clients of mine. So we ended up in the Philippines. Now, so I accidentally ended up building in the Philippines. However, now that I'm 9 years in and I understand the Philippines more, there are some reasons why I ended up staying in the Philippines. And I firmly believe that the Philippines is still to this day, like there's lots of places in Asia, but for me, the Philippines is the Mecca. Now, number one, the English. Now, there's 100 million people in the Philippines. Not all of them speak great English. In fact, most of them don't. They speak English, but not great. You want to find the ones that speak English like a mother tongue. So they don't speak it like a second language. There are people who are educated in English. They go to school in English. And they speak English better than I do. So some of our team, their English is so good that I'm just like, it's not a second language for them. It's a native tongue for them. Getting back to your comment about dialects, in the Philippines, there are lots of different dialects and there are lots of different languages within all the islands.
Yeah.
And some people in the Philippines will communicate with each other in English because that is the common language.
Yeah. Yeah.
So again, the English is very strong, not in everyone, but in a certain segment of the population. Number two, I feel like when I go to the Philippines, it's like it's in Asia, and of course they have their own culture. They're an amazingly fun culture, like a fun people, very family orientated. They love food, they love getting together. But in terms of, because they've worked a lot with Americans over the last few decades, they're actually quite a Western type of culture when you go there. You don't feel like you're somewhere else. You actually feel like you're just in Canada or the States or Australia. It's very, you know, the cafes and the restaurants, when you go, it just feels like home. You don't feel like it's any different. So that's number two, the understanding of Western, of people in Europe, Canada, Australia, the States is very high because they have a lot of experience dealing with us, and there's a big population of expats living there and all that sort of thing. However, the third piece though, is that can trip people up. So because the Philippines has great English, they have a great understanding of us as a culture, we make the mistake of thinking, oh, therefore they're all like us. They're not, they have their own culture. Yeah. And it pays to actually go and understand the Philippines culture, which took me a long time to do.
Yeah.
Understand their culture deeply. Their, you know, how they were brought up, the lens through which they see the world is different because of their, you know, politics, because of their heritage, their history of being, you know, taken over by other countries, etc. The Spanish were there, you know, all that sort of thing.
So it's really important to, yeah,
exactly. And understanding the lens through which they see the world is different, as it is in Australia versus Canada versus America versus Europe.
Yeah.
And I think if I've learned anything over the years in terms of leadership, in terms of dealing with different countries, in terms of hiring lots of people, it is that if you can understand the lens through which somebody else is seeing the world, your life will be a lot easier because it will be different. And spending time on that is powerful in business to understand your people, to understand that they are different to you and that you may have somebody misunderstanding your communication simply by virtue of the fact that they view the world differently.
Exactly.
And that's been very powerful for me to learn over the years. And this business has taught me that lesson over and over and over again. That's why I'm so deeply interested in it, you know?
Yeah. And so what I believe after listening to you about that is that I was born in Holland and especially in northeastern Holland, and the culture that I grew up in, Holland is very, very small, about 18 million people. Northeastern Holland, very, very small. You can go from one corner of the province to the other, you know, in about 20 minutes or half an hour. And so that, so I grew up in that kind of a setting. Our family was all within 10 minutes away, 15 minutes away. And then it was in this way that if somebody went to another part of Holland, more than an hour away, then when they heard about it, they said, oh my God, he's leaving, oh my God, we'll never see him again.
He's going to Mars.
Yeah, so, and so that's how it was. And the history goes all the way back to the 1600s, 1500s. And so when I came to Canada, Canada is a mosaic of people from all over the world. And a lot of first generation, second generation, even more so than the United States, you know, that people are from all over the world. And finding somebody when I came here, even in the 60s, that was born here in Prince George, I said, are you born in Prince George? Yeah, I'm born in Prince George. All the other people that were here when I came here in the 60s, because it was a boom town. They were just here to make money. Is the question usually was, when did you come and when are you leaving? Just enough time to make money and then go.
Australia is like that. I mean, yeah. People are from, this is a melting pot here of cultures all over. From everywhere. Right. Yes, everywhere, which is what I like about it, actually.
Yeah,
I find it very, it really opens your, I mean, travel, my mother always said to me, you know, travel, it just broadens your mindset so incredibly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, I mean, I was brought up in Ireland, a small country where there was only 4 million people. And my cousins and my family all lived within 10 minutes of me, probably like only 5 minutes of me as well. Yeah. So I get that. And when you go and see other cultures and you expand your horizons and you meet all these different people, you sort of see the similarities of humanity, but also the differences in perspective based on, like we said, where you came from, what the lens you were brought up with through which you see the world. Yeah. And yeah, understand. I think if more of us understood that, we would have less complex politics, and we would have less. We would understand each other's differences.
So we reaching the end of our podcast. Have you got any comments at the end?
Well, what an interesting conversation! I think the work that you're doing is fascinating. Your story is incredible. You know, to be 84 years old, I would never have picked that, and to be out podcasting and building this platform that you are, incredible, amazing story, and very inspiring, very inspiring.
So for all those people watching us from around the world, both for Barb and for myself, subscribe to our podcast, like it, share it with others, and also make comments to the podcast, because we will read them. It will give us encouragement, give us ideas, positive, negative, or whatever you feel about it. That's why we're doing the podcasts. That's why we're sharing our lives and on this amazing virtual media, that as we are sitting here together, Barb, and have exchanged our views, we already know that tens of thousands of people are watching us around the world. And it's only at its beginning. So it's going to get much bigger, much further. And it's an amazing, amazing media.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel honored to be on the show. And I'm going to go and check out episode number 203, where I can hear all about the driven to distraction concept.
And Dr. Halliwell.
Yes.
Excellent. Thanks, Barb. Appreciate our podcast. And again, let's make sure we stay in touch.
Definitely. Thanks so much, John.
Thanks, bye.